Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. The intelligence of Dinah West is one of the things that I consider to be a particular blessing as she briefs us each week on the state of the war for the free world. She is, of course, a longtime syndicated columnist and blogger par excellence these days at dinahwest.net, the author of three terrific books, The Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and most recently, The Red Thread, Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. Dinah, it's good to have you back. Welcome. Well, there seems to be ever more evidence of the anti-Trump conspiracy, and I wanted to get your take on the recent revelations about the persecution of Mike Flynn and this drama that's playing out so, well, Kafkaesque, as I say, begin to describe it, in the courtroom of Judge Emmett Sullivan. What do you make of what's going on here, Dinah, and how does this fit into the larger plot to take out President Donald Trump?
It Kafkaesque is just a weak word at this point, isn't it? I mean, the torment, the torture, just the endless pressure on this man and his family and his life and his fortune is just a shame on our history. I don't know what it is to bring it to an end, but it should happen today. You know, whatever it is President Trump could do, I don't know the legal relief here, but this has gone outside all manner of normal legal procedure long ago. And with this most recent twists and turns with this strange recourse outside the normal process to essentially bring in a de facto outside prosecutor's opinion on the whole thing is madness.
Yeah, Judge Sullivan seems to have lost, you know, any sense of judicial propriety. But this brings to mind, you know, Dinah, the degree to which the institutions of our government have actually been turned into sort of political warfare weapons. And you've documented this brilliantly, of course, in The Red Thread. Is there something about the ideology of Emmett Sullivan that seems to be operating here? There's obviously a very acute animus towards Mike Flynn personally, but is it really about Donald Trump and getting him in his case, do you think?
Yes, it has to be. Flynn is the essential piece here in the mechanism by which all of these leftists and are bonded. I mean, this was kind of the organizing theme of the coup, at least this aspect of it regarding spying, regarding protecting the spying process. I mean, remember, had General Flynn remained as Trump's advisor, he would have seen this FISA application or reapplication come across his desk, and that would have been the end of that. I mean, that would have been the gig would have been up right there. So this was a strategic takeout in terms of Flynn. I don't think that they were necessarily driven to remove him because of how he thought in the world, except that he was obviously interested in and devoting himself to carrying out the Trump agenda.
He was very critical of Barack Obama on his Islamist narratives and policies, I think it's fair to say. So that did cross into the ideological, I suppose. And again, personal animus to boot. But Dinah, I just wonder whether the role of a judge here in this kind of proceeding really allows for that kind of personal enmity or ideology to be applied. It seems as though that's, in a way, adding insult to injury of what's been done here to Mike Flynn over all these years.
Absolutely. But again, where is the recourse? Where is the reaction? How is the discipline enforced on a judge?
Well, of course, his new counsel, thank God, Sidney Powell, has introduced this unusual writ of mandibus, as it's called, to essentially get the appeals court to remove Judge Sullivan from this case, which seems entirely appropriate and necessary. I don't know whether that court has, which was very badly packed by the Obama team, will be able to see the way clear to do it. Though even Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg, no less. You don't get more left than she, has ruled for a unanimous Supreme Court that this kind of behavior, not even as egregious as what Judge Sullivan is doing, but just this idea that you're going to have outside people come in and make the case that isn't being made by people in the case is telling that this is way beyond bounds.
Absolutely. But it takes a Sidney Powell, that's such a brilliant woman, to make that kind of unusual argument. Whereas it would seem that were things functioning correctly in our system, that this kind of rogue behavior would indeed attract the attention of the court above or the other kind of correctives on rogue judges. I mean, this is where we see our whole system kind of systemically speaking out of whack. I mean, I don't know why I keep thinking of the man trying to go to the gym and being arrested by police. In relation to this, our rights are being stripped from us in all venues, whether it is in that kind of a situation or in this courtroom for General Flynn. And the correction from whether it's the Justice Department or from the superior courts above are just not there. Our rights are not being enforced on any level, whether at the gym or in General Flynn's courtroom. So this is a terrifying time, but I don't think it's just Sullivan per se. It's part of this larger effort that continues with this politicization of our courts.
And Diana, let me just, before we run out of time, very quickly, I did want to ask you about one other piece of this. Susan Rice's memo, the odd one that she wrote to herself, no less, on the day of the inauguration of Donald Trump. There's yet another revelation from it. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yes, well, it's a paragraph that was released to us finally. It should have been released 2.5 years ago. I mean, again, so many of these documents have been sitting there absolutely collecting dust, whereas American people should have already been aware of these things. But we got this further detail that President Obama was having this conversation with James Comey and Sally Yates in the Oval Office, and they were discussing General Flynn and Comey's concern, this is the word, about General Flynn's conversations, again, with this Russian ambassador, and they were essentially by the book, that phrase comes up again, and kind of monitoring the situation. Many people see this as another smoking gun, we should say. I'm a little concerned about, I don't know how it would be read, this notion of they being concerned about General Flynn being a Russian agent seems to be what is the subtext here that indeed does concern me, because I see a lot of these people slipping off the hook out of some twisted notion that they were seriously concerned about our country and that it was being, the Oval Office was being invaded by Russian agents once again. So to me, I'm not sure this will do what we hope it would do to the perpetrators of this conspiracy against not just our president, but our electoral process and the people who elected them and the American people.
But it's a further affirmation that the idea of getting Mike Flynn and getting Donald Trump and using this pretext of concern about Russians and so on was very much operating, and that Barack Obama was personally involved in it is, I think, the other key point here. Diana West, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time today. As always, we appreciate your visits and look forward to next week's. Next up, we'll speak with Ken Timmerman. We'll touch on this issue, I think, probably as well as Iran and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's a delight to say we have caught up with another of our friends and colleagues forward deployed, as I think of it, in France in this case. His name is Kenneth Timmerman. He's a remarkable investigative reporter, an author, and filmmaker, a man whose capabilities in terms of his finger on the pulse of international affairs as well as domestic ones is extraordinary, and we're always delighted to have a chance to visit with him. He is the author, most recently, of Deception, the making of the YouTube video, Hillary and Obama blamed for Benghazi. He is also the author of Dark Forces, The Truth About What Happened in Benghazi, and a welcome guest here always. He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for the work of his Foundation for Democracy in Iran, and we certainly think he's deserved it, and always pleased to have him with us to talk about Iran, among other things. Ken, it's good to have you back. Let me ask you first, before we get to Iran, Ken, I'm just interested, Diana West and I were having a somewhat sobering conversation, I have to say, about the condition of our polity, specifically the effects that now years of controversy and scandal associated with the abuse of power by the Obama administration, notably its exploitation of the intelligence and other capabilities of the United States government to basically wage political warfare against its adversary, Donald Trump, during the election and then subsequently his transition to the presidency and once in office. What do you make of all of this, Ken? Does this look like the banana republics that you've been spending a lot of time in the course of your career around the world? Or is there something else that's going on here, do you think?
Yeah, one of them, including France, by the way, I have to say, which has become a banana republic. But look, here's the big difference, Frank. What we witnessed in the United States from the Obama administration and from the Obama intelligence community, which was extremely politicized, is nothing short of a coup d'etat. They missed. They did not get the king. If you're going to hit the king, you'd better kill him. They did not kill the king. And the king is coming back, and he's going to get them in the end, I hope, as long as we still have some democratic institutions left. You know, I've been writing about the deep state for well over 10 years in the U.S. alone. I did a book in 2007 called Shadow Warriors. It was the story of how the CIA and the State Department sabotaged the Bush 43 administration in Iraq, and the Iraq policy, which was never to occupy Iraq. It was never to, you know, have an occupation government. It was to liberate and get out, get rid of the weapons, get rid of Saddam, and get out, go home, as Rumsfeld said in May of 2003. And they sabotaged Bush 43. This is far worse than what the deep state did to George W. Bush. This was an attempt to actually undo the presidency of Donald Trump and undo the election of 2016.
Chilling, and needs to be corrected, needless to say, with people being properly held accountable. You mentioned France and it becoming a banana republic. Emmanuel Macron certainly has seen his star diminished, shall we say, in terms of what was once considered to be one of the brightest, most promising politicians in Europe. Give us a sense from France, Ken, as to what's happening there at the moment and what it's likely to translate into in the days ahead.
You know, Frank, I lived here for 18 years in the 80s and the early 1990s and have been coming back ever since. We have a summer home here. I write my books from the south of France. But it's been astonishing to be under house arrest for 60 days with 66 million French people not allowed to go out without a written authorization, just like during the Nazi occupation. I was stunned to see the French come down with these rules, and then to watch Macron, the French call him le petit Macaron, which translates roughly into a little cookie, to see him lecture the French people in an elementary school classroom. This is where he does his TV interviews with a subservient TV, worse than CNN, if you wish. I mean, they are the establishment TV. And he lectures the French people sitting on an elementary school desk, telling the school children what's going to happen if they don't obey. And they will be reconfined, resubjected to house arrested if they do not obey in 2 weeks. I have never seen anything like it. I never thought this could happen here. I never thought what could happen in the United States is happening either. We are living in extraordinary times, and our freedoms are at great, great peril. And it's all because of communist China and what they have done.
It is. We'll be talking in the course of the show with Grant Newsom and Peter Husey about what the Chinese have wrought through this pestilence and what they may yet be trying to do about it. They're much in evidence in Europe these days. You're seeing, I think, in France and elsewhere, notably the acquiescence to China. It's 5G networks being just sort of the most obvious example, being incorporated into the telecommunication systems of some of our closest allies, to the great detriment of that alliance relationship. How do you think the French are seeing the Chinese in the midst of what they've unleashed upon the world?
Well, it's going to be interesting in the next couple of months if the French people start to change their attitude. But you're right about 5G. It's coming into our neighborhoods. In the area where I live in the south of France, the local township passed an ordinance allowing people to not adopt 5G electricity meters and telephone networks and other things connected to 5G run by Huawei, in other words, by the Chinese, into their homes. So people are beginning to become aware of it. In Italy, one of the reasons that the pandemic became so strong in northern Italy was because there was a Chinese community there working with the One Belt and One Road initiative with Communist China. So the Chinese are increasingly present here. You see European government bowing down to the World Health Organization as it covered up for Communist China, as it then propagated the myth of a pandemic that was going to kill millions of people, and of course it hasn't. So the role of China in Europe, I think, is going to be as much in public opinion as the role of China in the United States. I think you're going to see a pullback of manufacturing and a pullback of relations with Communist China.
Quick question, Ken. Is the opt-out provision being introduced in your neighborhood over health concerns or over concerns about what the Chinese might do to extract data and information at the expense of the privacy of individuals there?
So the opt-out on the electricity meters and the 5G is about security. It's not a health issue. It's about security.
I must say, I'm somewhat concerned about the health considerations here, too. Let me turn quickly to Iran. Ken, you've devoted much of your extraordinary career to raising up the alarm about what the mullahs are doing to their own people as well as to their region and what they would like to do to us, which is, of course, as they've said endlessly since they came to power, death to America. Give us sort of a status report of what's happening there and notably this development of the withdrawal of their forces from Syria.
The withdrawal of the Iranian forces from Syria, of the Revolutionary Guard forces, the Quds forces from Syria, is probably the most important development over the past 3 years in the Syrian civil war. And it is solely because of Israeli Air Force bombardments, which have been very targeted. They've been hitting the Iranians where they have their bases, where they're bringing in their weapons, where they're transferring the weapons to Hezbollah. The Israelis have been extremely successful with those attacks. The Iranians have been hit hard, and they've done what military people would do in those situations when they don't have backup. They're getting out of the way. So they're moving out of Syria. They're pretending they're not, but they are moving out of Syria. This is a huge positive development. We'll see where it leads to in the end. ISIS is also returning, but not in a territorial way. But to see the Iranians move out of Syria is a big move. It's a big thing.
So I'm heartened to hear you say this about Israeli power being the driving force here. It doesn't have to do with the financial difficulties that the regime is facing at the moment or internal unhappiness about foreign adventurism that the people of Iran have been expressing, perhaps less so with this coronavirus lockdown there, but nonetheless for quite some time.
Those things are important, but they're not what drive the Revolutionary Guards. The Revolutionary Guards are driven by hard realities. They have been hit. They've been hit hard. They are not, interestingly, they are not hit by sanctions the way the Iranian people or the civilian leadership are hit by sanctions because they have parallel financial networks. All of these guys, Qasem Soleimani, the former head of the Quds Force, he had companies in Germany where he would launder his money. The Germans never cracked down on them. Those companies still exist. So the IRGC has got money in many, many different places that has not been subjected to sanctions. They, by the way, still have a draw on Iraqi banks on the foreign currency exchange. They get a percentage of the float on foreign currency every single week. It's worth about $1 billion a month to the IRGC, completely off books, off the budget. We're not targeting it. We can't so far. So it's not money that's hit them. It's Israeli bombs.
Well, this is heartening. And the fact that the Iranians have not found a way to retaliate against the Israelis effectively is all the more remarkable. And I hope that that will continue to be the case. Needless to say, Ken Timmerman, thank you for this update on so many different topics and for your joining us from afar. And we're always glad to visit with you and hope we'll have a chance to do so again soon. In the meantime, stay well under lockdown in France. Next up, we'll speak with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, about China, challenge that it's posing to the region and to us, right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's a delight to say we are joined from Japan by Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired. He is a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. He formerly served, in addition to his role in the United States Marines, as a foreign service officer and also as a businessman in Japan, as an executive director of Morgan Stanley in Japan, and a secretary manager for Motorola Japan back in the day. It's good to have you back, Colonel. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes to join us. I wanted to start, especially given your background with Morgan Stanley, if I may, Grant, by asking for your thoughts as a former master of the universe, I guess is what they call people like you, as well as a veteran, about the decision that the president took at the very strong urging of the Committee on the Present Danger China, of which you are, I'm very pleased to say, a member, that he intervened to prevent the thrift savings plan, in which you may be yourself invested, from investing its beneficiaries' funds in China, specifically in some companies in China that are involved in building weapon systems with which to kill your comrades in arms, among others. Your thoughts about what the president has done here, and more generally, if you would, Grant, the advisability of other investors being induced to make similar investments through other means.
Yes, well, I was very pleased with what the president did. I think one is almost inclined to say hallelujah and wonder why it took a president this long to do this. Really, there is no justification for investing in a country that's main objective, by their own words, is to destroy America, dominate America, kick us out of Asia, take your pick. Just read the English translations of the Chinese press for a week, and you'll be horrified at really the blood-curdling rhetoric directed towards the United States that comes out of it. Now, even if it wasn't for that, you know, one asks, well, why would anyone invest in a country where they don't have rule of law? You cannot enforce a contract. And any foreign country company will only be as successful in China as the Chinese Communist Party allows it to be. If you had said, say it was North Carolina and you had similar circumstances, nobody would invest there. But here with China, you have the Westerners just go insane towards that market. And as you pointed out, it provides convertible currency, valuable foreign exchange to one of our enemies. And they use this for the Belt and Road Initiative. They use it to buy technology, to buy foreign companies. Strategic companies and strategic investments around the world and in the United States. So what the justification for a Western firm or particularly financial companies investing in China is, I really don't see what it is, other than some short-term profit.
Well, the short-term profit, interestingly enough, doesn't seem to be all that it's cracked up to be either. I think it's in close scrutiny. It turns out that a lot of people are losing their shirts on Chinese investments, companies that are simply frauds that go belly up, and people who hold so-called stock in those companies, of course, are left with nothing but the paper they're written on, I guess. But beyond that, as you say, there's this natty problem that some of these companies are involved in the Belt and Road Initiative. Some of them are involved in the expansion of these South China Sea islands and fortification of them. Some of them are involved in building weapons to be used against us. Some of them are helping the Chinese dominate space. Some of them are involved in oppressing the people of China, for that matter. I mean, human rights nightmares. So all of this would seem, just like the propaganda that is being pushed out by the Chinese, to be really red flags, if I could use that expression. And yet, until President Trump came along, we've seen very little appetite in either Republican or Democratic ranks to interpose objections to this, let alone to stop it, right?
Well, that's true. And certainly part of the dynamic, you know, when it comes to Western is of a certain type, investing in China, it's a very short-term focus, almost like a game of musical chairs, where you just have to do one deal, make a ton of money, and you get out with your money. You don't really care what happens after you leave. And that very much is the game, as you see it in industry, finance as well. If you want to get in, get your bonus, and be gone before the whole thing kind of goes apart. And it's human nature in a way, but also the Chinese have been very successful in really subverting and buying off the prominent U.S. politicians, really America's best and brightest. The classic case is you had Alibaba, the famous Chinese company that was listed, and the lawyer who was behind that is now the head of the SEC. Now, what could possibly be wrong with that?
It needs to be fixed, I think, is the point. And I was very heartened to see Larry Kudlow, the president's National Economic Council director, on Maria Bartiromo's show yesterday, holding forth quite, I think, robustly about the dangers to our country as well as our investors from the kinds of, well, cynical plays that you've just described. Granted, let me turn, if I may, quickly. I want to call attention on the part of our audience to some really important pieces that you've been writing recently at andmagazine.com and Asia Times about whether the United States military is now finally waking up to the reality that we're going to be facing a very serious challenge militarily from communist China, possibly not just in the Western Pacific. Tell us a little bit about your thinking.
Yes, I think that maybe in general, U.S. military has at long last woken up about the threat from China. And most importantly, you're actually allowed to see this. Just in one sort of illustrative story, I think it was around 2014, I told a group of visiting Japanese soldiers in Hawaii that they needed to really train hard so they could defend their country from the Chinese. And the headquarters Marine Corps heard that I had said this, and they went absolutely berserk because you can't say this, it will provoke China, blah, blah, blah. And this is the Marine Corps, mind you, supposedly the most bloodthirsty crowd, but the Marines were appeasing just as much as anyone, with exceptions. But that's how bad it was. But it's really much different now. And I think all the services, that one wonders about the U.S. Army, since they do insist on continuing to do some joint training with the Chinese. But in general, I think the Army gets it. But now there is very much a sense that China is an adversary, a potential enemy, and that we have to get things in order to be able to take them on. Unfortunately, we've waited so long that we are playing catch-up.
Let me ask you, Grant, we've talked about this off and on over the past year or so, but just a sort of current status check, if I can. China, of course, has unleashed on the world this virus and pandemic. There's still an ongoing debate about whether it was an engineered virus or whether this was an accident out of a laboratory that sprung it on the world. But I think there's now increasingly little debate, really, about the fact that the Chinese knew what they had on their hands and did nothing to stop its spread, in fact, took steps to ensure its spread. including, it appears, to some of our military assets, like the Teddy Roosevelt. During a port call in Vietnam, its crew apparently became afflicted with this thing. As you see it, from your vantage point in Japan, most especially, Grant, how does the situation look at the moment? Do you think the Chinese are now being further emboldened by what has happened to the United States and other nations in the region? And perhaps the bellicosity that you described in their propaganda is actually indicative of an increased appetite, not just on the part of certain military personnel, which is obvious, but on the part of Xi Jinping himself, to use this window to act on some of their longstanding ambitions, notably towards Taiwan.
I think so. It's, you look at what China's been doing since the virus has hit, and they've turned up the heat on Taiwan. They've sunk Vietnamese fishing boats. They've locked their fire control radars onto a Filipino ship. They've been pushing down towards Indonesia with their fishing fleet, the Coast Guard, and paramilitary ships. There was a collision with a Japanese ship off of Shanghai a few weeks ago, which didn't get that much attention. But the initial damage reports suggest that the Chinese fishing boat rammed the Japanese ship. So you can see they're just flexing throughout the region, and it's going after America's partners. I think that they move the baseline farther, and then once the Chinese virus business is over, they just expanded their hold a little farther, expanded their pressure. And I think that the U.S. Sort of going into this so-called lockdown, and the military as well, sort of restraining some of its activities because of the virus. And it adds to this Chinese sense that, well, they have the advantage, and when the time's right, they're going to make a move. But there's no sign that the virus has slowed down China's military activities, and the thinking behind the Chinese Communist Party thinking behind using force to ultimately dominate the region and drive the Americans out. So it has been, I think at the end of the day, the Chinese will come out a bit ahead on this.
We will be evaluating that closely, I think, in the days ahead with your help, Grant Newsom. Thank you for all you do, notably the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, as well as, of course, the Committee on the Present Danger China. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll talk with Peter Husey. We'll talk about nuclear threats from China and Russia and more. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's always a pleasure to have with us a man who seriously thinks about and helps the rest of us understand some of the most important issues, unfortunately, often get too little attention in our national security debates. I'm thinking specifically of nuclear forces and the capabilities that we have to deter enemies like Russia and China, and unfortunately, the rather frightening capabilities that they are now putting into place to threaten us. His name is Peter Husey. He is, among other things, the director for Strategic Deterrence Studies at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies. He is the master of ceremonies for a variety of meals in Washington, D.C. that are extraordinarily important vehicles for conversations between policymakers and congressional staff and others interested in these topics. And I've attended them myself over the years and learned an enormous amount from them. We're always appreciative for the chance to do so from Peter himself at these kinds of moments. Peter, it's good to have you back. Welcome. Let me ask you about a piece that you had at the National Interest a few days ago, Peter. You talked about two things that I'd like to cover, both elements of. First of all, what we're seeing in terms of increasing missile threats from both Russia and China. We talked just a moment ago with Colonel Grant Newsom about sort of the larger attitude of the Chinese and their increasing belligerence and the distinct possibility that they may see an opportunity to act on those ambitions in this pandemic moment. But tell us about the kinds of capabilities that they've been putting into place, as have their Russian allies.
Well, thanks, Frank. Let me walk through why we are in this situation compared to, let's say, the Cold War. As you and I remember, we worried about the huge number of warheads the Russians had in the thousands, over 10,000. They actually ended up with about 12,000 deployed nuclear strategic weapons. And we were worried about what Ronald Reagan called the window of vulnerability, where they would strike us with such a massive attack that they would limit dramatically the amount of retaliatory capability we had. Well, now we're down to officially 1,500 plus warheads on the Russian and Chinese, Russian side and the United States. But, and everybody says, well, what's the problem? We're 90% cut from where we were. What's happened is that Mr. Putin and his Chinese colleagues have adopted a new strategy called escalate to win, meaning in a conflict or a crisis, they will use very limited number of nuclear weapons to quickly strike us at key targets and to get us to stand down in a crisis or a conflict. Now, this doesn't mean how reckless they're going to be, I don't know. But what's happened with the development of hypersonic speed capable weapons, which the Russians have now deployed and the Chinese are now developing, is they can come at us very, very quickly. And here we have two problems. As officials in the Pentagon have said, defenses get you back to zero, meaning you get back to the status quo ante if you can shoot down this stuff. The problem is the speed of these missiles are such we can't see them coming. So that's why we're developing space-based sensors. Number two, we don't have the interceptors required, even if we could see them coming, as to where do we try to shoot them down. And we're developing those as well. Third, we have to develop a counteroffensive because you don't want to just have to sit there like a catcher's mitt and take it, okay? You don't want to give the guy an unimpeded ability to strike you. So you have a totally new situation where we're worried about limited strikes that come at us very fast and which we can't see. That's a very horse of a different color, as they said, as the Wizard of Oz said, about where we were in the Cold War. And as you said in your introduction, there is a tendency in Washington, D.C. to pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
No, I think this is a real problem. And one of the reasons we do this program, Peter, is to provide sort of what I think of as threat briefings on these sorts of things. I also use it to try to make sure that people understand not only the dangers that we're facing, but what we can do about it. And you've mentioned limited threats, both North Korean and Iranian limited threats are things that we've been contemplating for some time and arguably have been defending against with our missile defenses. What I think is the takeaway from your remarks today and your national interest piece is those limited threats are not the only ones that we're going to have to contend with, and some of them may be quite formidable, even if limited, notably with these hypersonic capabilities. So what sorts of defenses, Peter, are in prospect? You've mentioned space-based sensors, but the interceptors on the ground are not likely to be able to do much about these things. So what should we be doing?
They're necessary. The ones in Alaska and California are necessary, as are the we have probably somewhere in the vicinity, oh, pick a number between 1,500 and 2,000 and more than that, if you include our allies, interceptors around the world. Because as Robert Kaplan pointed out in his book, The Curse of Geography, missiles are the coin of the realm now for many, many countries. But we got kind of the feeling that, well, the limited strike from North Korea or Iran, that we can take care of that. Or that's the only one. Now, you're right. China and Russia are talking in their rhetoric and in their media outlets and in their strategy documents. Putin, in particular, what he calls escalate to win, meaning in a crisis or in even a conventional conflict, he will go or threaten to go nuclear very quickly. but in a limited way, not the Armageddon option. He's not going to hit us with thousands of warheads. He may not even hit the continental United States. We have a gap, and this is a gap that Senator Inhofe, chairman of the Armed Services Committee of the Senate, and ranking member Reid from Rhode Island, who's the Democrat, both said in a hearing was held in February of this year, we had a big gap here in terms of defending the nation with the missile defenses needed. Now, you can have an airplane, an F-35, to shoot down a hypersonic missile coming at you. You can have space-based interceptors. You can have a whole variety of things. But in particular, what worries me about the Russians is they have a new hypersonic speed-capable missile, about a 2,000-kilometer range, on their bombers. Now, that means you got to intercept the bomber. And so you need to defend yourself in an envelope that is 2,000 kilometers outside the continental circumference of the United States, keep them at bay so even if they launch it, it doesn't hit us. That requires the Air Force that we are planning to build. And I just want to say parenthetically, since Desert Storm in 1991, and this is actual fact, the United States Air Force has been in combat every day since that time with not a single day's exception, because we did Desert Storm, and then we did Kosovo, and then we did Iraq and Afghanistan, and we did, you know, the things we're doing in over Libya and so forth. We have been at war, but unfortunately we have the smallest Air Force in our history and the oldest. It was almost 28 years the average age of a United States Air Force plane. When Reagan became president and we had the Hollow Army, the average age of the Air Force was 12 years. It's now 20. It actually was 28. I think it's come down. I think under Mr. Trump, we've had an improvement, but it's in the 26, 27-year age. So we have the smallest and oldest Air Force. That's why we have to recapitalize the whole thing.
Yeah, of concern as well, as opposed to the Reagan era, we had a much smaller industrial base today to support the rebuilding of our military than we did then. And this is of great concern to me as well.
Certainly more consolidated. And when people look at the defense budget, they say, oh, it's what, 700 plus billion. True. But some of that is considerable amount is what are called overseas contingency ops, meaning Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places. But also a very high portion, half or more, is operations and maintenance and personnel, which doesn't buy you any weapon systems. So when you look at, and then the Chinese and Russian numbers, of course, are fake, that are used by the disarmament community to say, I saw today, is that the United States spends more than the rest of the world, our adversaries combined, and then they add in France and Germany and England just for fun. But if you take the amount of money, if we bought what China buys, and we bought what Russia buys, and we paid their soldiers, if they paid their soldiers what we get paid, what our soldiers get paid, their total amount they spend would exceed that of the United States of America. And we have world responsibilities as opposed to Russia and China are more regional in their threats. And again, we're protecting our friends. They're going after our friends.
Indeed. Horses of different colors, as you say. Peter Husey, particularly your budget analyses are so helpful, and we really appreciate your visits with us. I hope we might have you back to talk about soon the lowballing of some of the Chinese nuclear forces that we've been hearing about for some time as well. But that's for another day. Thank you for your time today. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.